Esther Park. I'm with RSF Social Finance here in San Francisco. And we are a boutique financial services institution serving investors, companies, and donors. And we have a couple of loan programs that we have that are dedicated solely to social enterprises. And in the financing of social enterprises, we've become slightly obsessed with how social enterprises can be financed in a way that may be different than sort of conventional financing. And what are ways to preserve mission, what are ways to achieve growth, and what are ways to maybe not achieve any of those things. Through our loan programs, we do try to create a supportive community of both investors and borrowers. So our borrowers are supported by over 1,000 investors, individual investors. And so actually our notes are open to both unaccredited and accredited investors, which means that for as little as $1,000, you can open an account with us and support these wonderful entrepreneurs. So I have to say that for myself, I've been on a number of panels where I've been asked to talk about financing for small businesses or social enterprises. And usually I'm up here with venture capitalists, bankers, philanthropists, and we talk about all of the ideals of how we give money out. But honestly, I've never been to a panel where the entrepreneurs actually tell the story of how they got financed, because that's where the real story is. That's what people really want to know, is what the true confessions are of some more experienced entrepreneurs. And so I'm pleased to say that I'm up here with some of the rock stars of the social enterprise industry. and these are all borrowers of RSF as well. So I'll just do a couple of, I'm just going to introduce them very quickly to you, and then each of them is going to give you their essentially financing biography of their business. So next to me I have Ahmed, and he's with Mimiti, and so that company was founded in 1999 by Ahmed and his sister Reem. Numi is now one of the fastest growing tea companies in the country and was recently named the largest importer of fair traded teas in the US and Canada. The company is rooted in four principles: balancing a healthy, nurturing product with a commitment to people, the planet, and profits. And Numi has been an RSF borrower since 2006 and was actually one of our first for-profit social enterprises in our portfolio. Sitting next to Ahmed is Christopher Mann with Guayaki. This company was launched in 1996 by a group of five young gentlemen, and Christopher Mann is also known as the chairman of the board, as I read. The company's vision is to protect and restore the South American rainforest and empower native forest people through an innovative business model that directly links customers' purchases to farming communities that are able to improve their lives and restore their lands. And so if you don't know Guayaki's products, they deal in yerba mate, and they have many loose leaf and tea products, but they also have some ready-to-drink products as well. I should also note that Numi also has brewed tea products and also ready-to-drink products. And there's a stack of them over there, and there's some right behind me as well. And next we have Lee Zimmerman from the Evergreen Lodge. The lodge itself is based in Yosemite, and it actually has been in existence since 1921, so it's been around for a long time. But Lee didn't get involved until about 2001, when he and two of his business partners, Brian Enderle and Stan Braun, bought the property. And so what they've done is they've created a social enterprise model around mentorship and job training for at-risk youth. And so that's part of the business that you might not see from the outside, but if you've never been to Evergreen Lodge near Yosemite, you really have to go. It's a beautiful, beautiful property. They've also implemented some exciting new practices that I recently learned about, including sourcing local food for their restaurant and some water saving, gray water systems there. So they're also, you know, beyond just the youth mentoring, they're also doing some social and environmental programs there And Evergreen has been a RSF farmer since 2008. And then finally, we have Thalian Tremaine from the Pachamama Coffee Cooperative. The Coffee Cooperative was founded in 2001. Another innovative business model that brings the value add piece of the supply chain back to the farming communities. So the company is wholly owned by thousands of family farmers in Peru, Nicaragua, Guatemala, Mexico, and Ethiopia. And their mission is to provide customers with premium coffee in the most direct way possible. And in doing so, improve the lives of small-scale farmers and their families. And Pachamama has been an RSF farmer since 2007. So I'm going to stop talking and let these guys tell their story. And a couple of them have slides, but a couple of them do not. So you're free to sit and chat or come up to the podium if you like.
Yes, sir. I'll just stay seated, if that's okay. Thanks, I'm Ahmed Rahim, and I started Mumi with my sister. I currently act as the CEO, and I'm sort of a product formulator and alchemist, so I do all the blends, what you drink of Mumi. So when we started just about 12 years ago, my sister and I had very little business experience. I was a bohemian artist for 15 years, and my sister is still a bohemian artist, but is our creative director and does everything that you see behind the brand. So when we got here, you know, we didn't put together a business plan. We didn't really do our competitive research. I had had tea houses over in Europe, in Prague, where I lived in Europe for about 10 years. And my last 5 years of them, I opened up these tea houses. And, you know, tea houses in Prague are very bohemian. They're kind of like coffee shops in Amsterdam. So you don't really need to think about a business plan that either. So coming here and seeing the opportunity of tea, it was quite prevalent that there wasn't really much creativity around tea. Everyone was doing the basic Earl Greys, the English breakfast, the chamomiles, and so on. So I had had a lot of experience with more unique herbs and more unique teas that hadn't come to this country. So I just saw it more as an opportunistic goal there, where, you know, they weren't offering lemon myrtle and rooibos and honeybush and pu'er and flowering tea and all these things that Mumi has done over the last 10, 11 years. And next year we're introducing a whole slew of new products that haven't been brought to this country yet, including some from South America. So for us it was more of an opportunity. So we just set out and said, okay, we don't have a business plan. We don't really, our business background is such that we can kind of bring a product and sell it. But so we just went to our dad and said, hey dad, we have this business idea. You know, and our dad has always been a great supporter of ours and always told us to follow our dreams, which at the end of the day is really what's gotten us to where we are as, you know, the nation's largest fair trade organic tea company. And it was more about just following our hearts. So he's like, well, you know, I have a house that's worth a lot. I can put it up and take a loan out of the bank. So we did that, and that was our first way to raise a little bit of capital. And it started as, you know, we could get $200,000 for the house. So we did that, and we burned through that pretty quickly, and my sister and I looked at each other, okay, what next? So knock on our dad again, say, hey, we're out of the $200,000, and, you know, slowly over the first 2-3 years, we grew that debt to almost 7 digits. And little did I know, I wasn't going back to my bohemian artistic life in the mountains of Prague where I had a farm. I was here for a while. So we eventually, after having that debt capped at a bank in Ohio through a home loan that our dad was kind enough to do for us, which we still have outstanding today, we eventually grew the company to a size where we were able to get a bank loan. Not a bank loan, but a bank ARIF, which is you know, against your receivables and inventory. So we had struggled those 3-4 years to get to that point where you're a solid business. We grew so rapidly that, you know, our cash to debt ratio wasn't great, and you know, our receivables payables wasn't where it wants to be and what banks normally look at. But we were fortunate to get to that point where we were able to finance our inventory and our receivables and take you know, a working line credit through a bank. And as it continued to grow quite rapidly, and as our values grew even more rapidly in organics and fair trade and sustainable packaging and all the trends that we sort of created, because those weren't around 10 years ago. Organics was just, you know, on the rise. Fair trade wasn't really well known yet. And sustainable packaging, you know, saving trees, you know, it was just for the tree huggers, but not for consumer packaged goods. So in our forge of doing that, then we were able to come to RSF, and as their platform, you know, again, the first for-profit business that RSF was able to finance, we were able to switch our loan over to them. And as we grew, you know, the thought of let's get investors came into our mind, and like, whoa, what are investors? And you know, growing a business, you really want to be smart. And this is where, if anyone is starting a business or growing a business or needs to bring in more money, this is really where the rubber meets the road. Getting money through debt or getting money through angels, or sorry, through family before you even get to angels, that's the easy part. Angels then was our next route. We were fortunate to meet a gentleman whose family started Tommy Hilfiger and Gloria Vanderbilt jeans way back in the 70s, and they did all the garments in India and Asia. So they gave us an investment. They were our sort of first official investor. Besides our sister and our mom and our dad and our brother, when we needed to make payroll, you know, we need 10,000 here, 15,000 there, they were all able to personally contribute whatever they had. But once that liquidated, we were able to get this sort of angel investor to put in almost $500,000 just to get us into the next phase of growth. But we felt proud. We were able to really bring on somebody that wasn't within the family, wasn't sort of a family member, but more of an angel. And even though it was a little bit more of an institutional finance, that it was an outside person, and we created an official board and so on, it was still more of an angel type. And I think in creating a sustainable, socially driven business with a clear vision, you want to make sure you bring people that are aligned in your vision. So as we continue to grow, and we exceeded the $10 million mark in our business, and you know, now there's investors knocking at our door, you know, which was really a fortunate part for us. We were growing it in the beginning on just shoestrings and just the grassroots sort of level. Now we had it every trade show we're going at. Every week you're getting one or two calls. They're seeing us in all the SPINS reports, which is the, you know, the syndicated data that comes from retailers. You know, people are calling us, hey, you guys need money, you guys need money. And we had that relationship with RSF, which was good to at least keep our inventory and our receivables flowing so we didn't have to finance that ourselves. We were then in the driver's seat, which was really a fortunate place for us to be. It was very lucky, and looking back at it, we could have made a lot of mistakes. We made some mistakes, but we could have made, you know, mistakes worth millions that would have hurt us. But I think in some ways we played it smart. We really brought the right people on to a considerable size of business, where then at that point we were able to pick and choose which investors we wanted to bring on. So we did a lot of searches. We probably reviewed over 100 investors, and we narrowed it down to about three. And all three of them, they're more private equity and venture capitalists. All three of them had clear visions on sustainable values. They really cared about organics. It was part of their mission statement. So we ended up settling with a firm called Triple Bottom Line, which ironically, a couple of folks were ex-RSF, one of them being the founder, and one of them was the chair. So it was really fortunate that they started TBL, which we found to be quite aligned with our values being a triple bottom line company. And that was our first sort of official investment, and that was about 3-4 years ago, where we took on a couple million from them. And then again, as we continued to grow, and then obviously the economy also had some hard times in 08 and 09, that we needed capital just to sustain, because we have a big seasonality in our business. We have a high peaks in the winter and the lows in the summer, where we do burn through cash, whether we like it or not, unless we want to make some serious operational changes. But during that time, we again wanted to raise a bigger round. This was a couple of years ago, in the 6-7 million range, to really bring out the bottled drinks and really create a bigger swing in our business and see some real big trajectory growth, because we were going in the 60, 70, 80, 90% range year over year. Now we're back on that 40, 50% growth, but it really needed that capital to really give us an oomph. And you know, in the beverage world, when you start competing with Coca-Cola and you're really playing with Lipton, you need that capital to push ahead. We have been in the last 5 years able to keep ourselves fairly profitable, more at the break even, I should say, three of the last 5 years. But again, that seasonality, it's good to have that cushion. So we did make a big round with another firm here in the city called Catamount. And again, it was, you know, they looked at, I think in 09, they looked at 1,200 deals, and they only chose one, which was us. And they also had invested in a company Foods, like Seventh Generation, and Revolution Foods, which you might know of, and they founded a company called Nest Naturals out of the East Bay. So we were, again, very particular. We still get today over a dozen calls a month from investors or banks that are very interested in our business, you know, and now that we've grown considerably since that point of taking money from the first angel investor to TBL to Catamount, we are considering future rounds. But for us, the most important thing, and the thing I always like to leave in talking about money, is make sure you're aligned with visions. Because if you bring in money, it is literally a marriage, and you're getting in bed with someone, and if you're not, you don't want to turn over your pillow and look at that person and have the same story to share. It's not a fun place to be, because, no, I'm using that as a metaphor, because that's what it's like, you know, and those that have a business or don't, I'm sure understand it, but especially in a company that's so vision aligned and mission driven, you know, because if you have somebody that doesn't care about, you know, if we took away our fair trade and organic values, there's $2, $3, $4 million we can put in our back pocket. If we just went to a low grade tea without caring for the farmers or caring for the earth. So just to sum it up, we still have some cash cushion for us. We still have the bank debt from our father's home. We have been paying it down over the years. It's not the focus. The focus is still to grow the business and keep a profitable bottom line. But at the end of the day, what we really strive to do in the investment side is partner with people like RSF, New Resource Bank, investors, and family members that all believe in what we're doing and why we're doing it.
It's a great story. I've been a great friend of Hawkins for a long time. I've never really heard the whole story that way, so it's cool. We have a similar story in many ways. I'm Chris Mann with YIT Sustainable Rainforest Products. We have a product called Yerba Mate, which, unlike tea, although most people will consider it tea or look at it very similar to tea, it's a new category, and it's something that no one really knew what to make about it. And it's funny, we've been pretty consciously focused on growing the business for the long haul. Yet, as we do grow, we get the same thing. We get these letters all the time. And just today, I was at a breakfast, and a guy came up and said, "Hi, how's everything going?" I said, "Oh, it's going really great." He's like, "Is it different being like with a bigger company now?" And I'm like, "Well, what do you mean?" He's like, "Oh, I heard you guys got bought." No, we didn't get bought. But it just keeps circling in the ether, because you just hear about all these companies that get bought. And there's nothing really, you know, necessarily wrong with that, because I think there's going to be certain companies that need to do that. They need to push the boundaries, get bought, absorbed into a larger company. But I think there also needs to be companies that are really going with more of a pure model that they want to be around for the long haul. And that's really what Guayaquil represented from the beginning. I was involved in a vegan restaurant prior to Guayaquil, and that was a challenge, to say the least. We were 100% organic back in 95. When it was very hard to find organic. We worked with 60 local farmers. We had, you know, tons of, you know, like 30 part-time employees, and we're all like committed to the core, to the business, but I can't make it today. But I really feel strongly that we have to do this, and this. So it really taught me a lot. You can relate, I'm sure, having a lot. So it really taught us a lot about, you know, the expectations that you have going into a business and sort of what is that balance. And for us, the big debate all along was always, do we go really deep or do we go why? And by why, meaning more, you know, superficial, growing faster, getting more out there, being able to impact more people, but maybe not at the same depth, versus really going deep in the community and having a really deep impact, but maybe not growing the business as fast. And we never really resolved it with the restaurant. We kind of tried to do all of it, and so we didn't really have a business model that could work doing both of it. So that was a learning that I really took from the Guayaquil. So from the beginning, we were clear that we didn't want to start out raising equity capital. there were five of us, and quickly, you know, others that were all partners. So it was kind of a similar kind of thing where it was never about one or two of us. And so from the beginning, it was never about, you know, there's one owner and we're going to do things a certain way, and then at some point maybe sell or not sell. It was really a partnership from the very beginning. And I think that framed a lot of how we interact with each other, how we work with each other. And because of that, we were able to attract the attention of a small local bank. And, you know, those do still exist here and there. And had a personal relationship rather than just, you know, plugging in all our numbers into a spreadsheet. the president of the bank just really believed in what we were doing. Wow, this is something I can get behind. So we got an SBA loan for $50,000 back in 97. And then we got a second one in 98 for $100,000. We got a third one for $200,000 in 99. And that really enabled us to get off the ground. And then we leveraged that to the hill with credit cards. So, you know, we all were maxed out. You know, you get those 2% offers, we're like, all right, we're taking it. And so we had, you know, several hundred thousand in credit card debt. We had, you know, at one point, I guess about $350,000 in an SBA loan. And that really got us off the ground. You know, it was, you know, in the scheme of things, it felt like a lot of money when we got it, but it went really, it felt like we never had enough. And so I think on some levels, it kind of brought this feeling of like, well, someday we're going to have this capital and we're going to be able to do this opportunity and this opportunity, but right now we're going to stay focused and do what we do. And it really carried through into the business as we expanded because, you know, one thing is that, you know, as a business, and especially consumer products, when you're out in the field, there's so many opportunities. And how do you really drill down and find what are the right opportunities to go for? So for us, being lean on cash was really a big advantage because we were lean on cash, but we had a lot of people. And we were really passionate about what we did. So we really leveraged that aspect of it. And I think what we found was that we grew at a slower rate, but we grew very organically. So we had a really deep connection with our customers, both people that actually drank mate as well as our retailers and also distributors. There's kind of three layers of customers. And we started over the years to really build a rapport and build a level of trust to where we ran into issues we could lean on, you know, on that network. And that's been a huge lesson for us. We came into around 2000, 2001 and started to expand more nationally and looked at like, okay, I think we need some capital. Let's look at raising some outside capital. So we looked at equity and we started networking through Social Venture Network as well as Investor Circle. And our very first Investor Circle meeting, gave a great presentation, and then we super fired up, and then we didn't get a single call. But our second Investor Circle, we got two calls, and they both came through. And so, and then we did a third Investor Circle, and so we ended up raising about 500 total through Investor Circle over a couple year period. So I think one of the lessons there, a lot of people call me and say, hey, what are we thinking about doing Investor Circle? Is that a good way to go? And what I usually say is that I think it's a great way to go. You have to temper your expectation because it's not like you're just going to show up and people are going to start throwing money at you. It's like you really need to build those relationships. And the third time we went, we raised some capital from someone who said, you know, I've seen your presentation for the third time now, and you're still here and you're still passionate, so, you know, now's the time. And sometimes that's what it takes. So flash forward to about 2005. So we raised a lot of money in, we raised a lot of investors, very small amount of money. So I have some stats, I'm trying to remember if I'm going to have to pull up a cheat sheet, but I think we have 43 investors total, and 26 of them were $50,000 or less. Seven are employees, three were employees at the time, so 10 total there. 14 family members of you know, ourselves are employees, on top of, I think, 14 more that have stock options. And then I think we only have four investors that are over 200,000, and those are all in the last couple of years. So overall, we've raised about $6 million. $4.5 million of that was just in the last 4 years. So to Achmed's point, as we rolled out with the ready-to-drink beverage, that's an incredibly competitive category. The business model tends to be you lose a lot of money for years and years and years. And you get some angel money or you get some VC money, and you get some private equity money, and then you get Coke or Pepsi buying you. And that only works for about 1 in 100 businesses, and it doesn't necessarily work that well even for the one that goes through it, in my opinion, and relative to what we were trying to do. So we didn't see that being a model, and we felt like as soon as we got on to working with venture capital, private equity, that we'd kind of be on this treadmill that, you know, just no matter how intentional people are, there is a model that, you know, like a business structure around those partnerships that are, you know, 3 to 5, maybe 7 years. And so you'll find most of those deals close in that period of time. And we felt like our business, because we're focused in the rainforest, we work with indigenous communities, our plans in the forest are 40-year plans, that a 5 or 7 year plan just wasn't going to be enough time for us. And so we continued to look for the right angel partners, and when we needed to raise capital for the ready to drink, we found a foundation that was super aligned with what we were doing. They had actually, one of my partners had actually lived at the ranch where they are organic farmers as well, and same story, you know, tried to get them invested for like 5 years, and even went down to the projects, checked it out, it was amazing, love what you guys are doing, but we don't think it's really a business. You know, it's a nice thing to do, but it's not really a business. And we have our philanthropical dollars that we put over here, but our investment dollars need to be focused. And in 2003, so we were at that point about 6 years in, they finally made an investment of about $250,000. And as we came to the round in 2006, they were so happy with the investment that they came in for, I think, 1.75, yeah, so we became a total of 2 million. Became our biggest investor and just a super core partner. And part of the transition that happened with them was that they also got really passionate about MRI, which is mission-related investing, where they don't separate the 5% and the 95% mission-wise. They still have their 5% that's their asset base that they have to, you know, they have to give to charity each year. But their 95%, they said, that's a huge chunk of money. And we want to really be able to leverage that to drive the same kind of mission that we're driving with the 5%. It makes no sense for us to fight, you know, the 95% with 5% and then fund the 95%. And so that's something that's, you know, actively happening right now. I think it's a huge opportunity for all of us going forward. But these are, again, huge structures with huge legal structures behind them. And it takes time and it takes patience for it to happen. But there are groups that are starting to move in that direction. And so this particular foundation is a great partner for us. And then I would open the door for a private company that we have a lot of respect for, which is Clif Bar. And a lot of people probably know Gary Erickson's story, that he was, you know, at the table to sign away selling the company for a large chunk of money, I think, you know, a couple hundred million, and just couldn't do it, walked away. And so we've always really had a lot of respect for him because of feeling aligned in that way. And so they started a fund as well, and so now they're investing in companies, and so they've been investing in YT as well. And so it's one where we felt like we could do some strategic leverage. It's not part of the Clif Bar, it's a separate entity. So we have, you know, we work together with Clif, but at the same point, we're not tied to, you know, if Clif does sell at some point, it's not part of, you know, tied to our future directly. So that was a really, really great model for us. And everything was sailing along, 2007, 2008, and then all of a sudden, things got a little rocky in 2008. The wheels came off, and we were planning 40-50% growth, and we realized, you know what, it's not going to happen. And rather than try and push it and risk getting in a situation where we might run out of cash, because we were planning to grow that and then do another raise in 2009, we decided to slow down a little bit, cut back on some of our expenses, find a way to structure our business to where we would be at break even. I mentioned briefly that the beverage business is always one that, you know, you lose a lot of money trying to sell Coke and Pepsi. Well, for us, we always lost just a little bit of money, just a little bit, so that we could stay in business, but also have enough that we could give the samples and spend the money we needed to stay on the shelves and you know, fight in the beverage space. But in 2008, we said, you know what, we're going to have to really cut back here. In 2009, we're going to be EBITDA positive, we're just going to make it happen. And to bridge the gap, we went to RSF, and that's where we were part of their mezzanine fund. And the mezzanine fund is a much higher interest rate, but for us the trade-off was it was unsecured, and so it enabled us to still have other debt that we had, and we could look at it really as an equity-type deal, but that we'd be able to pay off. And when we look at what the value of our equity is, it was much less, the value of our equity was much greater than even, you know, a high interest rate that we were paying. I think our interest rate ended up being around 19-20% because there was a revenue kicker and other aspects to it. So it's very expensive money. But you also, when you look at equity, you sometimes don't think it's expensive money because you get it and you have it and there you go. But at some point there's a time where you're either gonna pay that money back out or you're gonna do dividends or you're gonna do something along those lines. And that money's going to appreciate. And most investors are expecting it to appreciate more than 20%. So in the scheme of things, it sounds like expensive debt, and it is expensive debt, but it can be a great way to bridge a gap. And so for us, it bridged the gap for about a year, and then we transitioned into the asset-based fund, so our interest rate dropped in about a third or something, which was wonderful. And at that point, it made us bankable as well. So now we're running profitably, Our goal was to, you know, as things improved a little bit, at least on paper in 2010, and I still think the fundamentals of our economy is a wreck, but the stores were starting to pick up again, sales were happening, so we pushed a little bit in 2010, knowing from 2011 on, we're going to be a profitable business and we're not in a profitable long-term net. So that ultimately means that we don't need to raise outside capital. We can now function on debt, more lines of credit to fund inventory, fund receivables, and things like that. There's a number of different resources that can be utilized for that. Unless we get to a point where there's just a huge opportunity for us to grow and feel like, okay, we've got, you know, a 50, 75% opportunity here that we want to take. And in that case, the capital is always available. So we felt like by being a little bit more conservative financially, we're, you know, our baseline forecast this year is to grow about 18%, which is, you know, a pretty solid number, but certainly doesn't get anyone super excited. But yet, when we sit down with our retailers and some of the books, we're like, wow, that's amazing. You know, a lot of companies are 25% or flat or negative. So you hear all these stories about, you know, the high flyers, but the reality is most people are sailing, you know, sort of right at survival rate. And so if you can grow your business strongly enough and in a sustainable way, I think you really build it for the long haul. And you can really lay that foundation so that when the opportunity is right, then you can seize it. And so that's how we've taken the opportunity here, and we feel like we've got some, you know, some great things behind us. We're a finalist in the BBC World Challenge now. They've recognized the business model and what we're doing. They made a beautiful video for us. And so that will direct some funds into a project we're doing in South America for food security. So on that note, I'd like to pass it on.